May it please the court. Stock prices decline for all kinds of reasons. A stock price decline by itself says nothing about whether a previous misrepresentation distorted the market price. Only a price decline that is caused by a disclosure that corrects a previous misrepresentation gives rise to the inference that the previous misrepresentation distorted the market price. By declining to consider whether the December 7th disclosure was corrective or instead whether it merely revealed new bad news about Halliburton, the district judge violated Halliburton II's mandate that price impact issues must be fully litigated and vetted at the class certification stage. If this disclosure was just new bad news, all we know is that the price dropped because of some negative news entering the market. It's only if we can find that the disclosure corrected a previous misrepresentation, that is, it revealed some truth obscured by the previous misrepresentation, that we can infer that the price was previously inflated.
So to litigate this issue, you'd get into whether there was a misrepresentation and then whether the disclosure corrected that misrepresentation.
Not exactly, Your Honor, because the court would assume that there was a misrepresentation. That's assumed.
How can you have a correction if you don't have a misrepresentation?
Well, you look at whether the disclosure corrected some fact that was obscured by the statement, whether just assuming that it's a misrepresentation. So putting it concretely, imagine Halliburton had said, we are very confident in our defense in this Baltimore jury trial. We predict victory. Well, regardless of whether that was intentionally false or a misrepresentation, the December 7th disclosure would have a corrective relationship. Similarly, if Halliburton had said, we are confident that our asbestos reserves are X, we're confident that they are sufficient, that would be, and then Halliburton later had to say, our asbestos reserves are not sufficient, that would at least have some corrective effect. It's a very different scenario when Halliburton says what it said in this case, that we have made our best estimate of our asbestos reserves. We warn the market repeatedly that its asbestos reserves may need to be increased because of litigation uncertainties. And those factors are what led this court to hold as a matter of law in the first appeal in this case that Halliburton's disclosures were, quote, negative but not corrective. And the court said because Halliburton is keeping the market abreast, we see in the evidence concerning the asbestos litigation a pattern of Halliburton keeping the market abreast of asbestos developments as they occurred and its necessary adjustments to the litigation reserve. We think this undermines any conclusion that the asbestos-related statements corrected prior misrepresentations.
So do you agree then that you could not litigate the question of whether there was a misrepresentation?
Yes, we agree with that. And courts litigate the question of whether there's a corrective disclosure all the time separate from whether there's a misrepresentation. You can easily imagine a summary judgment that doesn't challenge falsity and scienter, but challenges whether there's loss causation and whether there's a corrective disclosure. I think that's nothing novel in the law. And in fact, that's exactly the question that this court addressed in the first appeal in this case. It didn't litigate the falsity issue, but it did say when you have some unexpected new bad news about some bad event that happens to the company, but it's an event that the company warned about, it's an event that the company has made fulsome and aggressive disclosures about and has repeatedly warned the market, then you can't draw the inference that there's a correction when this new bad news happens.
Well, does this create a predominance problem? I mean, isn't this an issue that all the class has in common?
I think it's related to predominance in exactly the same way that all price impact questions relate to predominance. In other words, if there is no price impact, yes, I think ultimately the entire class fails. But the Supreme Court was well aware of that, and it heard that argument in Halliburton II. In fact, it said, quote, fair enough, but we go on and hold that the court must consider price impact rebuttals because price impact is the fundamental premise of the basic presumption, and therefore, by definition, it's a Rule 23 issue. So anything relating or rebutting the evidence of price impact is, by definition, a Rule 23 issue
well,
that has to be.
Why isn't this just totally intertwined with materiality? I mean, and the Supreme Court made it very clear that materiality is not to be handled at class certification, didn't it?
Yes, sure did. And this is not related to materiality because materiality has to do with whether the misrepresentation alters the total mix of information that a reasonable investor would want to know. It's focused on the content of the misrepresentation. What we are focused on here is whether the disclosure at the back end of the class period corrected the misrepresentation. So the ultimate question we're trying to answer is whether or not the misrepresentation distorted the market price.
Isn't the real, I mean, the question that's sort of unanswered in Halliburton II, the second part that seems to be the issue here, is what's the scope of your client's rebuttal proof? And so what would help me most would be for you to identify in the hearing or in the record, but not just in her ruling, what evidence you offered to disconnect the two. What was it that Judge Lynn refused to consider that wasn't something? Because when I look at her ruling from page 45 to 53, she considers your expert's explanations for all the other possible causes of the price drop and accepts that your robust no-impact defense disproved as to all but December 7th.
Yes, and let me first give a little bit of background to that and then directly go to that question. I think the scope of the price impact rebuttal right is informed by what the plaintiff's price impact theory is. So there, this court said in the second appeal that there are two ways to prove price impact: a misrepresentation that inflates the market price at the time it's made, or a corrective disclosure that decreases the market price. So Halliburton's rebuttal evidence went to both of those points. And now I'm getting directly to your question, which is both sides did event studies. We looked at every single alleged misrepresentation. Everybody agrees there's no price movement at the time of the misrepresentation. So the fund falls back to a separate argument, which is that the price declines are evidence of price impact. Now, of course, price declines are not evidence of anything about the front end of the class period unless those price declines are correctively linked to the misrepresentations. Now, what Judge Lynn did, as to five of the alleged corrective disclosures, she denied class certification. But she did that only because there was no statistically significant price decline at the time of the alleged corrective disclosures. As to the sixth corrective disclosure, the December 7th disclosure, she found that there was a statistically significant price decline, and she found that it was caused by the December 7th disclosure. What she did not do is go to the next step and consider our rebuttal argument that the December 7th disclosure was simply a revelation of new bad news. It was not some correction.
But I thought she did. She broke down Allen's arguments into four categories and then goes through each and concludes with a sentence. Allen's conclusion with respect to December 7 is there no price impact as to the alleged misrepresentation. It seems like she's therefore finding the connection.
Well, I think we have to take the district court at its word when it said 13 times in the opinion, I'm not going to consider whether the disclosures are corrective.
But to have reversible, I guess I'm back to the first question I asked you. Specifically, what evidence did she refuse to consider that would break the causal link?
Sure. I think two things. First of all, she refused to consider the expert's analysis that the December 7th disclosure did not correct anything that was in any of the previous misrepresentations. And you can find that at page 269, note 32, is one example where she said that sort of statement. I'll quote it. Halliburton's expert also argues that the disclosure was not corrective and the market did not see it as such. However, as already discussed, the court does not address...
That's quoting her opinion. But I'm just asking you, did you make an offer of proof as to some sort of absurdity between the misrepresentation or whatever it would be that's unrelated to any conceivable disclosure? Well, what did you say, please consider this, it's an alternate explanation that she didn't consider?
That the December 7th disclosure was just new bad news, which is not something that corrected a previous misrepresentation. So there's a whole line of case law stretching way back and then culminating, I think, in this court's decision in the first appeal in this case, which says multiple times that when a company reveals new bad news, that price decline is not evidence of some previous price impact. It's only when the disclosure corrects some previous misrepresentation that you have evidence of price impact. So that was our argument, is that when you look at the disclosure, it's just a revelation that something bad happened to the company. It happens to be something the company warned about repeatedly. And when you line up that disclosure with the misrepresentations that are alleged, you don't have a corrective relationship. You just have the company disclosing some new bad news. And
so did the experts say it's not corrective?
Yes.
Okay, where did the experts say this is not corrective?
Well, I was just reading in footnote 32 is one place that she says that, and there are multiple times throughout.
That's the district court talking about it, isn't it?
Yes, but it's talking about the expert arguing that this is not corrective and showing that it's not corrective.
The district court says, I'm not going to consider that.
Yes, yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly what we say it should have considered.
So the district court should have considered that it wasn't corrective, and it's that failure that's at issue.
Yes.
So why isn't the remedy, even if you are correct, for us to remand for the district court to consider whether it was corrective or not?
Well, I think that is one remedy that's open to this court. Now, another thing that the district court, I would think, should have considered is this court's previous opinion in the first appeal in this case, which held the December 7th disclosure is not corrective as a matter of law, and therefore could not be evidence of price impact. I think the fact that the district judge didn't grapple with that question at all, and the expert testimony which was based on that question, it shows, A, that she did not address the correctiveness question one way or the other, but B, that it would be futile, I think, to remand at this point, because we're 14 years into the litigation, and it would certainly be wasteful of judicial resources to relitigate again one of the only issues that both courts have agreed upon in this case, which is whether the December 7th disclosure is corrective or not. And I will say, Judge Higginson, that our expert also explained how the market did not view the December 7th disclosure as correcting any previous misrepresentation. It in fact, the expert testified that the market had impounded X number of dollars of asbestos liability, and that when this disclosure came out, it did not correct any misunderstanding that was on the market. And that was what the district court said. I'm not going to consider that argument because I think that's a truth on the market argument.
Mm-hmm.
If you're correct that the district court should have considered corrective, in the abstract, what do we do, though, with our previous decision in Ludlow? This is problematic for your position, isn't it? Even if you're right theoretically, we have to follow our case law.
Yes, but Ludlow did not address whether the correctiveness inquiry was a valid part of the price impact rebuttal. There was no price impact rebuttal in Ludlow. In Ludlow, the defendant simply argued, tried to inject the correctiveness question into whether there was a class-wide damages methodology. And in that context, the Ludlow court said correctiveness is just a class-wide merits issue that's barred by Amgen and is barred by Halliburton.
But is correctiveness just a class-wide merits issue?
Not when it is being used to rebut the plaintiff's sole theory of price impact. The plaintiff cannot say, here is our theory of price impact, and now you can't rebut it because that's loss causation. The Supreme Court, in fact, listened to all of the arguments that the fund is now making under the guise of Ludlow, that this was just a class-wide merits issue, that this violates Halliburton 1 because it has to do with loss causation. On page 42 of our brief, we quote the argument that they made along those lines. The Supreme Court listened to all of that, and it said price impact has to be fully litigated. We're not going to artificially limit the price impact inquiry.
Do you agree that this feature of price impact that you want to show is a common issue to everyone in the class?
Yes, in the same sense that price impact is always a common issue to everybody in the class.
Common issue, just like materiality is a common issue.
Yes, and the Supreme Court said, we hear the fund's arguments that price impact is like materiality in certain ways, but there can be no doubt that the Supreme Court said Halliburton has the right to make its price impact rebuttal on remand. And it's important to note that when it said that, it had this very same evidence in front of it. The Supreme Court said at the outset of its opinion, Halliburton is relying on the same evidence to show no price impact that it previously relied upon to show no loss causation in the earlier stages of the case.
Tell me if I'm oversimplifying. Of course, I was on the earlier panel. The Supreme Court did say we had it wrong. But if it really is just this connection, I think their allegation is that your client said at the beginning, fortunately, we've got a lot more reserves than liabilities. But then much later, they've got a disclosure. Oh, unfortunately, we were wrong. When we said that, it was wrong. Our liabilities, look at this jury verdict out of Belt with Warren, vastly will exceed our reserve. There would be an obvious connection there.
If that were the record, there would be a connection, but there is no disclosure that says our asbestos reserves were inadequate because of the December 7th verdict. There's just a disclosure of the verdict. And in fact, when Halliburton later had to restate its asbestos reserves at the end of the year, it just recalculated the exact same number, and the plaintiffs don't allege that's a mistake. They don't.
What I would expect this issue to be pertinent to would be if Allen were to say, if the alleged misrepresentation was, guess what, we've got Chinese drywall exposure. Well, that would have no connection to an earlier assertion, we've got reserves to cover this situation, asbestos. There you'd have a disconnection. But it didn't seem to me that Judge Lynn ever said, I'm not going to allow you to show that disconnection. I refuse. I'm not going to consider that. Instead, she listened to your expert, Allen, offer other theories for why the price drop happened, but she discredited them. So even though she, in her order, keeps saying, we're not going to address that, I don't see that, in fact, she didn't address it. So I'm asking, what was the disconnection that you offered that she says, I'm not going to hear that?
And just to be clear, the fund doesn't even argue that Judge Lynn addressed the correctiveness question. I think we have to take her at her word, but I understand there are sentences in her opinion. I think if you read those sentences carefully, what they refer to is whether there could be some corrective relationship between a verdict and prior misrepresentations. One of the sentences has the words could not be right in the middle of it. And then if you look at, that's on the last page of her opinion, if you look at her record site, it has nothing to do with correctiveness in this case. I think she also says that the market had a new view of Halliburton's asbestos reserves. Well, the market can have new views of particular facts, but if those new views are just caused by new bad news, that's one thing. That's not evidence of price impact from some previous misrepresentation. And the argument that we put on is that all you had here was new bad news. And I think Your Honor, in your question, respectfully set the bar a little too low for relatedness. It's not just relatedness. Remember, Dura held the disclosure can't merely touch upon the topic of the previous misrepresentation. And Dura itself said that there is no correction, quote, there's no correction when the decline is caused by, quote, new firm-specific facts, conditions, or other events. I think what you had here with the verdict was a new firm-specific fact, condition, or other events, and that's also consistent with this court's decision in the Flowserve case, where this court said it's not enough that the market gets some general impression that something was wrong in the same general subject matter area, and it's not enough that the market knows the true financial condition of the company. There actually has to be a correction. And it's that correction, that corrective relationship that this court said was lacking as a matter of law in its first opinion in this case.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Boies.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court, David Boies, representing the plaintiffs. I want to begin with what counsel was just ending with, which is when he said that they were contending that the December announcement were represented new firm specific facts. That's what he said. Now that is exactly what the United States Supreme Court in Halliburton 1 said represented the loss causation question that was not appropriate for a class certification stage determination. The court in Halliburton 1, talking about Dura, talking about exactly the same quote that you just heard from counsel, said that is not appropriate. That is loss causation, whether the new news is or is not new firm specific facts is a loss causation question.
But facts
can... Is that relevant to loss causation and to price impact? Why isn't that also relevant to price impact?
Because, Your Honor, price impact, the way the Supreme Court was using it, relates to whether or not you have an efficient market or not. That is, whether information is transmitted to the market price. That's the only reason that it's relevant, because price impact, to the extent it's relevant at class certification stage, the Supreme Court says, and this court said in Ludlow, is only relevant because it may undermine the efficient market hypothesis. That is, it may undermine the proposition that says price information is going to be transmitted into the market price. It does not have to do with whether or not the disclosure is or is not fraudulent. It doesn't have to do with the content. It has to do with whether, whatever the content is, it is transmitted into the market price. That is price impact. I respectfully suggest you cannot make sense of Amgen, Halliburton I, and Halliburton II if what you say is that you can litigate at the class certification stage whether there is an appropriate fit between the disclosure and the prior misrepresentation.
Trouble with that, Halliburton I and Amgen do stand for that proposition, but I thought that the court explicitly said that's as to the plaintiff, and now Halliburton II comes along and creates an asymmetry which says as to defendants, if we're going to start out with the basic presumption, we at least have to allow a very robust defense to price impact, and therefore what maybe plaintiffs can't offer proof of, defendants can.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would say that that's not what the court said. I think what the court said was that plaintiff and defendant can litigate price impact, but not loss causation, not materiality, and not common issues.
That's what in Amgen, I thought the test in Amgen was adopted was the government's amicus brief test. If there's a single objective inquiry, win, lose, it affects the whole class. It's not appropriate for the class certification stage. But I guess I'm doubting that interpretation now that we've got Halliburton II, that it can be, you know, here, of course, if there were a complete disconnect. Let me phrase it as a question, because it's important, his final assertion. Are you not urging that even if Judge Lynn was mistaken to say there's a categorical, she would be an error to categorically refuse to consider rebuttal proof that there's no link, right, between the disclosure drop price and the alleged earlier misrepresentation? You're not arguing that that would be error, and yet she did allow them to present all arguments?
I think she allowed them to present all arguments that went to price impact. She did not allow them to address correctiveness that did not go to price impact. And if I could go back just to the court's question about the common issues, because Judge Davis raised this as well. The court in Halliburton II, not just Halliburton I and not just Amgen, but in Halliburton II, and this is at page 2416 of 134 Supreme Court Reporter, the court says that the issue at class certification stage is whether you are risking the certification of classes in which individual issues will end up overwhelming common ones. That's what the court said. Now, that's also what this court said in Ludlow. And when you have a question as to whether a subsequent disclosure did or did not correct a prior misrepresentation, that is something that will rise or fall for all class members together. And that's what the Supreme Court said in Halliburton I, Halliburton II, and Amgen, and what this court said in Ludlow was something that was not appropriate for litigation at the class certification stage.
But then in Halliburton II, the court embraces Amgen, but just very much narrows it and says, well, materiality is quite different. But if we're going to allow plaintiffs to go create this rebuttable presumption based on price impact, defendants have got to be able to attack that same mechanism.
They can attack the price impact, but not the correctiveness part. Your Honor, let me.
But what if the disclosure, just the same hypothetical I gave him, disclosure is, oh my goodness, we've got a lot of exposure on drywall. And your alleged misrepresentation was that they had assured that you had adequate resource reserves for, they wouldn't be able to offer that to disconnect at the class certification stage? That disconnection, unrelatedness, wouldn't be?
Not at the class certification.
Really?
Remember at the pleading stage.
Yes, no.
We had to plead it. That is, we had to plead loss causation at the pleading stage. We've got to demonstrate that there's sufficient evidence for that at the summary judgment stage. Mm-hmm. The only question is whether in between, in the class certification stage, they get to litigate that issue or not.
Right.
And that's what the Supreme Court has said no. They've said, and not just in Halliburton 1 and Amgen. In Halliburton 2, what they're saying is that the test is whether you're going to be risking the certification of classes in which individual issues will end up overwhelming common ones. And that cannot be when you're dealing with the issue of so-called correctiveness.
Assuming arguendo that correctiveness is an appropriate inquiry under price impact and that your statement is so assuming arguendo that that's true, what result here? Should we remand for Judge Lynn to consider the correctiveness?
Well, I mean, I guess you'd have to, Your Honor.
Do you have evidence of that it's not corrective?
We have evidence that it is correct.
Did you have that in the record already?
Yes, there is record. There is evidence in the record of that. We had an expert report. The expert report is sealed, but it's referred to in our brief. We introduced a variety of evidence.
So
that
they
showed,
don't win as a matter of law on that correctiveness point.
I'm sorry, say?
They don't win on the correctiveness point.
No.
Right out.
No, they can't, because both at the pleading stage and the court should understand that this whole issue is in front of the court right now on summary judgment. In other words, they've challenged correctiveness. We've both put in extensive briefs, affidavits, evidence, litigating the correctiveness issue. The correctiveness issue is going to get litigated. They moved to dismiss on the grounds that we had not adequately alleged correctiveness. That was denied. They've now moved for summary judgment on the grounds that we didn't prove or we didn't put in evidence of correctiveness. That's going to be decided by the district court. The issue here is whether at the class certification stage they can litigate under a different standard of proof than they will face at the summary judgment stage the issue of whether or not it is corrective. That is an issue that is common to all members of the class.
Let me ask you this. Did Judge Lynn, there's the only evidence she considered on price impact, whether the stock dropped the day of the so-called corrective statement? Is that all she considered?
Basically, Your Honor, that's correct.
Well, she didn't consider that the general market fell or that there's a general fall in the market in this category of stocks? Or
no, she did consider that, because that had to be considered in determining whether it was statistically significant or not. That is, she had to look at the issues as to whether this was a general market decline or something like that. What she did not make a finding on is they conceded that there were false statements with Sienter about their investment reserves. That's what we contended. That's what they conceded. That's in the record. The question was, when this disclosure came out on December 7th and the stock dropped 40 or 50%, was that corrective of their prior representations that they were okay in terms of their asbestos reserves? And let me just refer to a couple of pieces in the record, because the court has asked. For example, at the record on appeal 20503, there is an analyst report that says, Halliburton buried as investors stop believing. Quote, shares dove to 9-year lows Friday as investors lost faith in the company's claims that asbestos litigation would never catch up with it. Record on Appeal 16875 has similar kind of language.
How does that show that it's corrective and not just negative?
Because what they're saying is that the company had been claiming that it was okay. Yes, there was some boilerplate language in some of their disclosures. This court in the Collins case at 20 Federal Reporter 3rd 160 deals with that issue. But what you don't have is you don't have, in this case, any rebuttal of price impact. The price impact was there. Let me give you an illustration. One of the cases they cite is the IBEW case from the Eighth Circuit. And that, I think, illustrates exactly what the Supreme Court was talking about. In that case, the defendant came forward with evidence that the allegedly fraudulent statement did not move the market, because immediately before that, there was a non-actionable statement that said the same thing. That did move the market. When the second statement came out 2 hours later, it didn't move the market at all. Now, the court assumed that that was a fraudulent statement, but it said there was no price impact, because what had happened was that they had proven that when this occurred, there was no movement in the price of the stock. Here, there is unquestionably movement in the price of the stock, and the question is that movement a corrective disclosure, or is it, in counsel's words and the words of Dura, new firm-specific facts? Now, that's exactly what the Supreme Court says is loss causation. That's exactly what the Supreme Court says is not an appropriate subject for class certification.
On that proposition, I mean, get way back at basic, before I was even a lawyer, Justice White warned that there would not be much we could draw from the law. We'd have to be referring to economic theory. And so, sure enough, we've got a very small universe of cases that are relevant. Ludlow seems to be the only one that's post-Amgen, post-Halberton II, that you both are disagreeing over. So I'm going to switch the question. There has been scholarship that is discussing how much of Halberton II sort of backtracks on your heavy reliance on Halberton I. Do you have a single best law review that endorses your more expansive view that the Ludlow proposition that relatedness or tightness is still a common class question? Can you think of anything that endorses that as opposed to my apprehensiveness that what the Supreme Court said in Halberton II was that there's asymmetry and plaintiffs don't have to do it, but defendants get at least to attack very robustly the connection between the disclosure and drop and the alleged earlier misrepresentation?
I don't have a law review article, Your Honor. I do have Ludlow, though.
I know you've got Ludlow. Ludlow's sort of what I thought we were following in Halberton II panel level, thinking there's symmetry and this is a class question, but I read Halberton II to narrow that theory much more. And so I just want to, again, just last time I'll say it, your argument is not that even if Judge Lynn misspoke as to her inability to consider connective stuff, she actually heard everything that Halberton offered.
She heard everything Halberton had to offer.
And that they proposed through Ms. Allen these alternative link-breaking theories, and she discredited that and credited Chapman.
She did, but...
If that's true, where do we end up?
Your Honor, I think, for the sake of the clarity of the law, it's important that you end up where Ludlow was.
Yes, okay.
And Ludlow talks about exactly the question that we're dealing with here.
But not as to the defendant's opportunity. Ludlow's folk, right?
No, it was the defendant's opinion. I mean, it was.
I guess it was mixed.
It was mixed.
There's a sentence or two that.
Now, they say it's damages, but if you look at pages 687, 688, and 689 of the Federal Reporter decision in Ludlow, I do not believe that you can reconcile what the court says there with what Halliburton's argument is to this court, because what the court says in Ludlow is it addresses the very corrective issue that they're raising. They're raising the issue of, does this subsequent disclosure fit the allegedly misrepresentations that occurred earlier? And this court in Ludlow says that's not appropriate for class certification. And it says so for two reasons. And remember, this is Ludlow after Halliburton II. This is Ludlow, the court has the benefit of Halliburton I, Amgen, Halliburton II. And what the court in Ludlow is saying is that there are two reasons here. One, they say the class is going to rise or fall together, and if that's the case, then it's not appropriate for determination at class certification. And that is supportive of the language I keep coming back to in Halliburton II, where the court says you can go to price impact here because price impact does not necessarily risk the certification of classes in which individual issues will end up overwhelming common ones.
Before you, because your time's getting close, they made a point that I didn't see answered in your brief. They argue that you, in briefing in Halliburton II, specifically said and warned the Supreme Court that if price impact rebuttal proof would be required, then there would have to be discovery to determine if the disclosure, quote, did in fact correct the earlier misrepresentation.
Your Honor,
am I wrong on that? Or
they're wrong on that, and they're wrong in the following sense. What they were talking about to the Supreme Court were two things. They were talking about price impact, and they were talking about correctiveness. And we said, with respect to both price impact and correctiveness, that there would have to be some discovery.
Yeah.
However, we made very clear that the correctiveness part of it was not something that we thought could be done at the class certification.
Oh, you said discovery would be, have to determine if the disclosure did, in fact, the verb was used, correct the earlier misrepresentation.
Exactly. Yes. If the court held that you had to
that price impact rebuttal proof
permit correctiveness, then you'd have to have discovery. In other words, and when we're arguing in Halliburton II, we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to hold. We don't know whether they're going to hold that you get to do correctiveness. We don't know whether they're going to hold you're going to do price impact. So we're telling them all the things that are going to have to happen if they hold this or if they hold that.
And they did hold that, and so why doesn't correctiveness follow?
Because they didn't hold correctiveness.
But they held price impact, which price you said impact, would lead to correctiveness. No, I mean, I'm not trying to bind you with your statement. But
there's a difference between price impact and correctiveness. And that's the difference that this court recognized in Ludlow and that is illustrated in the IBEW case. In the IBEW case, you don't have price impact. In Ludlow, the court holds that the fit between the disclosure and the prior misrepresentation, that is the correctiveness issue. The court is talking about the correctiveness issue in Ludlow. And yes, they're talking about it in terms of damages, but they are talking about it as whether or not it is something that is susceptible of class-wide determination. And this court says, and I think this is consistent with Amgen, Halliburton I, Halliburton II, the court says that there are two reasons. One is that it rises or falls for the whole class. Two, it doesn't take away from the efficient market hypothesis. Remember, the whole reason the Supreme Court in Halliburton II says you get to do price impact is because if there is no price impact, that means you don't have an efficient market. Here, correctiveness has nothing to do with whether there's an efficient market. The drop shows that there's an efficient market. It shows that the market is absorbing this information. The question, whether that information shows fraud or not, that's a merits issue. That's not an efficient market issue. What the court is saying in Ludlow very clearly is that you only look at the class certification stage at those issues that will undermine the efficient market hypothesis. Nothing, whether this is corrective or not corrective, nothing there is going to undermine the efficient market hypothesis. The Supreme Court in Halliburton II says the reason that you look at price impact is because if you can prove no price impact, you've undermined the efficient market hypothesis. And right. Therefore,
tell me why you think the correctiveness is more related to efficiency of the market than loss causation. I view loss causation as an individual item, and that's the way the Supreme Court viewed it.
Yes.
So how is this common issue of correctiveness more like loss causation?
I think that both loss causation and correctiveness and materiality are all issues that have two things in common. One, the class rises or falls together, so individual issues can never predominate. And two, none of them implicate the fraud on the market or efficient market thesis. In other words, you only allow something at the price impact. The only reason you allow price impact evidence is because some price impact evidence can undermine the efficient market hypothesis. That's what the Supreme Court says in Halliburton II. Correctiveness can't. Whether this is corrective or not doesn't have anything to do with whether it's an efficient market. The Supreme Court says you're only allowing price impact because price impact evidence can rebut the efficient market hypothesis. Correctiveness can't. Materiality can. The Supreme Court says materiality, you've got to have materiality for an efficient market. But they say even so, it's not appropriate for class certification because the class rises or falls. The Supreme Court says there are two independent reasons why correctiveness does not apply at the class certification stage. Two independent reasons. One, the class rises or falls together, so individual issues cannot predominate. And second, because it doesn't have anything to do with the efficient market hypothesis. The market in Halliburton stock was very efficient. This thing came out on December 7th and the stock dropped. Now, they say, well, but that was because there was new firm-specific news. That has nothing to do with whether the market's efficient. Nothing at all. And the Supreme Court has said that's the only thing that you look at class certification stage, whether something has rebutted the efficient market hypothesis. It's what this court said in Ludlow as well. I would just urge you to read those three pages of Ludlow and read that one page of Halliburton II. And I know my time is up.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Back to you, Mr. Street.
Thank you. I respectfully suggest that Mr. Boies has an extremely and non-textually narrow reading of Halliburton II. It does not say that the reason you are allowed to make a price impact rebuttal is because that undermines the efficient market theory. What it says is that price impact itself is the fundamental premise of the basic presumption. Because if the price is not distorted at the time of the transaction, then there is, for whatever reason, then there is no basis for presuming that the class relied in common on the misrepresentation as reflected in the market price. And I would also suggest that Mr. Boies is misdefining price impact. Price impact means a very specific thing under the Supreme Court's case law. It means whether the misrepresentation distorted the market price. Now, if that's all we're going to look at in this case, then the fund loses because the price did not move at the time of the misrepresentation. That's what happened in the IBEW versus Best Buy case. The price did not move. The Eighth Circuit said, therefore, price impact is rebutted. We did that same event study here and looked at every single misrepresentation, and the price did not move. Now, in reaction to that, the fund fell back and said, yes, but the price declined upon these disclosures. But a price decline, a mere price movement at some time in the class period, is not price impact. For some later price decline to be relevant to price impact at the time of the misrepresentation, there has to be a corrective link between that disclosure and between the representation.
Three quick questions. Do you have any scholarship that you think supports your narrower reading of where we are after Halberton II?
We are surprised by how little scholarship there is out there.
What's his proposition that we're, if not bound by Ludlow, the statement about tightness being a class common question for the class pretty much controls our analysis here. Is Ludlow still valid and distinguishable, or are those statements in Ludlow incorrect in light of Halberton?
It's valid and distinguishable because on the three pages that Mr. Boies cites, the defendant was not trying to make a price impact rebuttal with the correctiveness question. The defendant was trying to inject the correctiveness question completely unrelated to price impact. It was doing it to say that there was not a common...
So the last question is, you would agree that you can't just label evidence as price impact to get around if it in fact is immateriality evidence, Amgen still keeps it out.
Absolutely.
If it in fact is loss causation, Halberton 1 may or may not keep it out unless it's serving two functions, right?
Yes, I don't think the court has to answer the materiality question here because that's not presented, but...
I guess then I'm back to that worry about what was the evidence that was kept out so that we know which box it falls in.
Sure, and just to be clear, I think Judge Lynn let all of the evidence come in. The problem is she did not assess that evidence to determine whether the disclosure was corrective or not. When this court had held that it was corrective, it was not corrective as a matter of law. What she assessed is whether there were some other factors external to the December 7th disclosure that caused
way back in BASIC, when the court said to use the modifier any, you get to show any proof. I thought that related to external causes of the drop unrelated to, it's a relatedness inquiry, the alleged misrepresentation. So again, we'd be back at, did Ms. Allen, was she unable to articulate something that made the misrepresentation unrelated to the price drop?
Let me give you the...
Now, they aren't embracing that, so right. Oh, I may be triply wrong.
And I think the reason they're not embracing it is for a good reason, and that's because she did not do the inquiry that she was required to do. And I'll give you some page sites where Ms. Allen talked about her evidence that there was not an adequate correction, a corrective relationship. It's 16685 through 16701. In the record. And I get back to my previous point on my opening argument, Judge Higginson, that I think the question is not just relatedness. I think this court correctly said in the first appeal in this case, unless the price declined because of the correction to a prior misleading statement, there would be no inference raised that the original allegedly false statement caused an inflation in the price to begin with. So unless you have that very tight fit, you don't get to reverse engineer price impact from these later price declines. And Ludlow, on those three pages that Mr. Boies referred to, doesn't even cite Halberton II. So I think it's very hard to read Ludlow as somehow narrowing Halberton II down to only looking at the front end price impact. And as Your Honor pointed out, only looking at the front end price impact, and then when the defendant raises the back end price drop, I'm sorry, when the plaintiff raises the back-end price drop, then the defendant's hands are tied and it's not allowed to rebut. I think what Halberton 1 said is the plaintiff does not have to prove loss causation to invoke the presumption. But when the plaintiff puts forward a price impact theory that relies on the back-end price decline, the defendant gets to rebut by testing that theory and saying, is it just new bad news that has nothing to do with the misrepresentation, or is it a corrective disclosure?
Opposing counsel says that there is evidence on their side about the correctiveness issue in the record also, because the judge let in all the evidence but then chose not to make a decision on correctiveness. Is that true? And if so, then would remand necessarily be the correct result if you win on the correctiveness point?
Well, there is evidence that they label as correctiveness evidence. It's the same sort of evidence that this court had before it in the first appeal, which is that this disclosure sort of gave a general impression about the market, that the agglomeration of misrepresentations gave the wrong impression. And this court said, no, actually the alleged misrepresentations kept the market accurately up to date and warned about the possibility of these verdicts, and therefore a verdict being disclosed does not correct that. And I would just point out that I think in response to Judge Higginson's question that the fund really did embrace the absurd hypotheticals that we gave in our brief. It said, hey, so long as you can identify some price drop caused by something that has to do with the company, you cannot test that relationship at all. That's the position they took before Judge Lynn. Judge Lynn embraced that position. And if the court is somehow still inclined to read Judge Lynn's opinion as considering that evidence and applying some test to it, it certainly was not the proper Rule 301 test. It certainly didn't just consider whether Halliburton had put on evidence that a fact finder could credit to rebut the correctiveness question. She almost said Halliburton has to rule this out conclusively. And even in those contexts, she was just talking about whether Halliburton had ruled out other causes for the price drop, not whether the December 7th was new bad news.
You have a red light.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.